At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Why is it that with sparkling water, I'm always playing guessing games with what flavor I'm drinking? Is it citrus? Is it aluminum can flavored? Not sure. Sparkling ice, though, they really mean flavor. Like in-your-face flavor. Orange mango, black raspberry. Don't even get me started on the strawberry lemonade. Kiwi strawberry slid right into my taste buds' DMs last night and let them know who's boss. No subtleties there and no sugar either. But it does have vitamins and antioxidants. Find sparkling ice at a major grocery store or club retailer near you. Sparkling ice. Anything but subtle.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, and welcome to the Politics Guys with your hosts, Jay Parson and Michael Baranowski.
Welcome to the Politics Guys. I'm Michael Baranowski, a political scientist at Northern Kentucky University. My co-host this week, as always, is Cleveland area attorney and sometime Republican strategist, Jay Carson. We start once again with another rocky week for Donald Trump. Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign chair, resigned this week after allegations that he received millions of dollars advising the corrupt pro-Russian government of Viktor Yanukovych, who was removed from power in 2014. Though, according to a number of Trump campaign insiders, all of whom seem to want to remain anonymous, the Ukraine issue wasn't really why Manafort was pushed out, or technically why he chose to resign. He was brought into the campaign to discipline Trump and help him become more presidential, and by all accounts, Trump bristled at this. Now, to replace Manafort, Trump has chosen Stephen Bannon, the executive chairman of the stridently pro-Trump website Breitbart News. So, what did you think about this this campaign shakeup for Donald Trump, Jay?
Well, I think it's much needed. Is it too little, too late? I don't know. You know, it's one of those you never know the insides of when someone leaves, and you know, there's often a number of reasons and sometimes valid reasons on both sides, and maybe it's just not a good fit. Although Paul Manafort and Trump would seem to be a good fit. He's also enlisted Kellyanne Conway, another sort of well-known right-wing pollster commentator. And, you know, I would say in the last week, since this change, the Trump messaging has been much more consistent and more to the point, and there's been less, you know, again, this is also so weird because it's sort of relative, you know. I mean, compared to any other political candidate, it's one thing. Compared to, you know, prior Trump, it's something else. But he's been much more disciplined this last week. Now, maybe that's because he just got the new campaign team this week, and maybe this will only last for a week. But I think his statements in Milwaukee last week and statements in Virginia yesterday were, you know, the speeches were on point. They're on message. He had a couple good lines. He was working off a teleprompter. You could tell. And again, you look at this guy and you say, oh, well, he's not crazy. He sounded like a regular presidential candidate to a certain extent. Okay. Again, on the Trump scale.
Sure. You know, but and that's kind of at odds with what we know about Bannon. I mean, for the most part, he's a very aggressive sort of guy. He's wants Trump to be Trumpier, but Trump has been less Trumpy in a way. And so, yeah, I'm kind of skeptical that actually will last. It seems to me, and you know, this has been something that's been talked about by some folks in the media for the last week, that maybe at this point, Trump realizes that his chances of actually becoming the next president are not that great. And so he's setting things up for the next move. He's surrounding himself with media people. And there's talk that he's maybe setting up a post-presidential run TV network or media empire to challenge Fox.
I had heard that. And that's pretty funny. I mean, I guess we just wait and see. I don't know that those thoughts necessarily go into these immediate changes in the campaign team.
Yeah.
I think it's more driven by realizing that, look, you do have a real problem in the polls here. Although if people haven't seen it, the Trump lawyer on responding on CNN with the says who.
Oh, that was very funny. Yeah.
I mean, that's hilarious. And it's just, again, just bizarre to some extent. I think the changes are so far good ones. We'll see if he stays on point. And to the point of Trump being aggressive, it's one thing to be aggressive and focused. And that can be a really good thing. Trump's problems before were he was largely aggressive and unfocused. He was aggressive in going after the Khan family or Paul Ryan or you know, other people who he's not running against, which is what was really unhelpful. Aggressive and Trumpy is fine, but you still need to have that focus and discipline.
You know, for me, I don't really know that they're good changes. I think what Trump has been doing this last week is better than what he had done before, but he had really nowhere to go but up. But it just seems to me that if your campaign's in trouble, what you don't do is hire somebody to run it who's never even participated in a national campaign, not to mention run one before. I mean, this is not the sort of thing that you can, you know, learn as you go, especially given the fact that it's not going to be really that long before early voting begins. And when you have no kind of organization, and, you know, there are a couple pieces here. The reason why people are thinking that maybe Trump is looking ahead. Number one, Roger Ailes is supposedly helping him prepare for debates, and they're on friendly terms. And of course, Roger Ailes recently was ousted from Fox News.
Sure.
Because
so Roger's looking for work. So,
yeah, you know, and not only that, but it turns out, at least sources say, that Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, and Greta Van Susteren have clauses in their contracts that allow them to leave Fox News if Roger Ailes leaves. Put that together, and they were all supporters of Ailes, and put that together, and maybe bring in Sarah Palin and some other folks, and you have Bannon here with the Breitbart, and all of a sudden you can sort of see the genesis of something. And I think is Trump thinking that far ahead? Who knows? But it's an interesting idea, because if Trump is actually thinking about doing this, I think that would be an absolute disaster for the Republican Party going forward. Because if Trump loses, and there's a very good chance that he's going to lose, you know, the hope was that Trump would kind of fade away. But if he can do this sort of stabbed in the back, elections were rigged, system was rigged narrative for the next 4 years and threaten to run again, I mean, this only, you know, keeps that split in the Republican Party going, which would be, I think, absolutely horrible for the GOP. And I certainly hope that that's not the case.
Sure. And I hope that's not the case, too. But I think there's going to be a sense of, and again, this is all really speculation at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
This is happens, and if he puts this together and so forth. You know, if you remember, Ross Perot ran again in 1996.
Right.
And I don't recall – I mean, he got something, you know, I believe it was like 18% of the vote in 92. Mm-hmm. And I think it was, you know, single digits below 5 in 1996.
Right.
You know, and I think that's – perhaps if there's a Trump wants to continue this, I think his appeal grows more selective as time rolls on.
Well, I mean, yeah,
much like Sarah Palin's did too. I mean, well, I think you can say when Sarah Palin was first announced as the VP for McCain, it was a huge bump, and she was the conservative darling, and she was the future of the party. And then after a couple months, after the crazy started to set in, you know, again, she's doing reality shows.
Well, here's where I think Trump is really smarter, or I could see this actually. I think as a campaigner, he's extraordinarily limited, and, you know, running a national campaign and being a national candidate's a tough thing to do. But as a marketer, I think he's potentially brilliant. And the idea that you can kind of keep this brand going and make it very profitable by creating your own media network, I think that makes a lot of sense. And obviously that's not something that either Perot or Palin were able to do, had the resources to do. So again, right. maybe I'm giving Trump too much credit. I mean, I think he's an awful businessman. I certainly don't think he's the success he claims to be. I think he's an awful candidate. I think he would be an awful president. But as a marketer, I think he really knows his stuff as a marketer.
I mean, just getting the name out there and the way he
Absolutely.
Does that. But the other piece, going more back to the campaign, is with the new shift, Trump is still so far behind on the basic campaign blocking and tackling type stuff. The setting up the field offices, the setting up the get out the votes, the fundraising, all those things that he probably thinks are pretty boring, and they sort of are. But he is so far behind on those things, and I think that's going to start to show. It's starting to show already, and it's going to start to show. And to some extent, you can have all the marketing in the world, but if you don't have that infrastructure,
and you know,
I don't think you're going to succeed.
And we've talked about this before, and we said maybe there's this idea that he didn't really ever expect to get this far, and all of a sudden it's like, oh wow, I'm in the lead. Oh wow, I'm the nominee, and so what do I do now? And this kind of fits with this sort of larger, you know, some people suggested Donald Trump maybe doesn't even want to actually be president. He just simply wants to be really, really famous and adored by millions. And so this whole idea of maybe he's not really trying to win so much as to become even more famous and popular and so forth. I mean, there's a certain logic to it.
I could buy that. Yeah.
There's a certain logic to it. So, you know, another Trump story. Earlier this week, Trump gave a foreign policy speech in your old stomping grounds there, Youngstown, Ohio.
Yeah.
And in which he called for what he termed extreme vetting of immigrants to the United States, including the use of a questionnaire with an ideological test. And he also said that if elected, he would temporarily suspend immigration from what he called the most dangerous and volatile regions of the world. So what did you think about Trump's foreign policy remarks, Jay?
Well, I've said before, I think vetting immigrants, particularly from those dangerous areas, and we're talking Syria and Iraq. I think that makes a whole lot of sense. Extreme vetting. I'm not sure exactly what that means. And handing someone a questionnaire doesn't strike me as terribly extreme. Nor does it strike me as particularly effective.
Right. But you're okay with like an ideological test?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose.
Really?
I mean, look, if you're going to be – I mean, in terms of what kind of ideological test we're talking about, is it a thing of, look, if you're going to come here, do you promise not to advocate the violent overthrow of the United States government? Well, I think that's a fair question.
Well, sure. Yeah. And I wouldn't call that an ideological test. I'd call that you promise not to commit crimes. That's a potential criminality test. But for instance, like, are you a follower of Islam or something like that? You know, that's a different story.
Religious test. No, I would have problems with a religious test.
Okay. I see. Yeah. I see what you're saying.
Like that. To me, ideological means more just of
So, like, are you a supporter of ISIS?
What are your political beliefs? That kind of stuff.
Okay.
And again, I'm not sure. Look, I mean, this is one of those weird sort of things where, you know, the pro-gun people and myself always argue, look, you know, it's like putting up a gun-free zone sign that's going to stop the shooter.
Sure.
If you have someone who is is a terrorist and is going to commit some sort of act of terrorism, giving him a questionnaire and asking, are you a terrorist?
Yeah.
Check the box. I mean,
you will catch the dumbest terrorist, though. That's about it, you know.
So yeah. I'm not sure what that does. I mean, I think the more important thing are, you know, where are you from? Where were you born? What have you been doing? What's your job been? I mean, those sort of things that you can check people to see who they are. Now, the problem with that is that information is difficult to come by. They can lie on that too. And do we necessarily have the resources to do all that checking?
Well,
I don't know. So
what about temporary suspensions of immigration from entire countries or entire regions, as Trump seems to suggest he'd want to do?
No, I think that's the blanket things like that are just don't make sense. There are probably plenty of – I wouldn't say probably. I'm sure there are plenty of people who would like to immigrate here, who have completely good reasons, who have jobs waiting for them, who could really contribute to the American economy and American society and are absolutely no risk. And we shouldn't we're sort of hurting ourselves by not letting those people in, bringing those people in by doing some sort of a blanket block.
Absolutely.
But again, I think there needs to be a vetting process. It can't just be an open anyone who wants to come can. And we've talked before, there is a process. And it's, you know, in your view, it's pretty robust. But again, it's imperfect. I don't know whether there is a perfect one. So, you know, maybe there ought to be tightening, and those are tough details, and it's tough to sort of for us to hash it out just on our show today. But yeah, extreme vetting. I mean, again, just it sounds silly, and a questionnaire.
It sounds extreme.
Loyalty oath.
Yeah.
Again, just strikes me as sort of silly.
Yeah. Agreed. You know, it wasn't such a great week for Hillary Clinton exactly. Should mention on Tuesday, the FBI turned over transcripts of Clinton's interviews with the agency to Congress after demands from congressional Republicans, some of whom are, I would say, chomping at the bit to have her tried for perjury. Now, one of the revelations in the transcripts was that Clinton claimed that former Secretary of State Colin Powell advised her to use private email, and this is something that Secretary Powell later confirmed. Then on Friday, a federal judge approved a motion by the conservative group Judicial Watch ordering Clinton to answer in writing questions that the group posed related to her use of a private email server. But Clinton's answers are not due until November 14th, which is, of course, 6 days after the presidential election. So go ahead, Jay. You're going to say something about the Powell thing.
About the Powell thing, I think you have to take a look at Colin Powell issued a statement saying, no, what he said was he had set up a system whereby you could communicate non-classified information amongst the State Department. And he felt found it was easy. He notified everybody about this beforehand. And again, Powell's talking about, I believe this was in it was in the late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Am I correct?
It was in It was in the early 2000s because under Bush. Yeah.
Yeah. And this would have been a system where we didn't have the same internet stuff we did. And the structure of the State Department system was such that there wasn't a way to communicate non-classified information easily. They had one server. It was all classified.
Right.
So there was a big difference to say Colin Powell set up this system to communicate non-classified information amongst people. It was all public. Everyone knew about it. It wasn't set up as an attempt to evade, public record keeping law. It was a convenience. And as far as I know, Colin Powell didn't erase all the emails.
Right. Yeah. And just to be clear, so this was, you know, more than a decade ago. He was Secretary of State in the first Bush term from 2001 to 2005. And yeah, things weren't as advanced, and the rules, in fact, did change over time. And so what was okay under Secretary Powell wasn't really okay under Secretary Clinton. And, you know,
nor was hacking the kind of threat that it is now.
Sure, sure. And it's pretty clear that throughout this whole thing, Hillary Clinton, who has never been, you know, accused of being a smooth speaker, an elegant prevaricator, certainly not like her husband, has stumbled and has mischaracterized and has very awkwardly spun this thing. It's a big problem for her. It would be a huge problem for her if she were running against anyone but Donald Trump. Now, the thing with Judicial Watch, I don't think that's going to be that big of a deal simply because, you know, obviously she's not going to submit her answers before the election. And also, obviously, she's not going to say, well, yes, I did this and it was a total breach of policy and I threatened national security, you know, that kind of thing. She's, you know.
Right.
But also, I think this might be the best case scenario for Republicans, the fact that she doesn't have to respond until after the election. Because if there's a bombshell right before the election, which I wouldn't think there would be in any case, you know, there's the possibility that Trump could win. And I think that's the worst case scenario for everyone. But if it happens right after the election, you know, maybe Clinton's ability to govern is crippled, or at best, if you're a Republican, she's, you know, impeached and convicted. Now, I don't think any of those things would happen, and I would not hope that any of those things would happen. I've said before that what I think Hillary Clinton did was wrong but not illegal, was ill-advised, was horribly poor judgment, but not illegal, not a crime. I agree with the FBI on this. But in any case, I'm saying that, you know, certainly I think having it come out after the election is better for the country than if it comes out before the election. That's my argument.
Okay, I can see that. To me, what her answers are going to be, I don't believe there's going to be any reason why her answers that she would give to the Judicial Watch questions under oath would be any different than what she said the numerous times before.
Yeah. Now, one of her top aides is also being deposed, and I believe he has to provide answers before the election sometime in late October. But again, it's not like those answers are going to be very carefully considered, and I would be really surprised if there's any sort of a major revelation in those.
Well, the way this works is, you know, she'll have – at this point, Judicial Watch and essentially Congress will have statements under oath where now they can compare those statements to the various stories she's told,
right,
and match up the inconsistencies. That's more what this is for. And it sort of sets the here's what's under oath. And if we find something down the road, which I think would be certainly plausible, you know, given the
right.
Russians claim to have. That would contradict those statements. I agree that puts her. So this isn't. I think this is less of an election ploy or election strategy, or if you want to call it any of that. It's more just about boxing her in for the future. So I think you're right on that. I don't think it changes the election.
I guess
one way or the other. I don't think anyone's votes are going to change. They would be shocked by allegations that Hillary Clinton is lying under oath. So,
yeah, I think even if they can make some sort of a halfway, I was going to use another term, but this is a clean show, perjury charge. I mean, we've seen what happens when a Republican Congress tries to impeach and convict the Clinton, and I would expect the same sort of thing would happen again. But if they want to have at it,
we'll see. This is a different Clinton, though.
This is a different Clinton.
This is a different Clinton, and we're at a different time.
That's true. It's a much more polarized time.
If we had had a sputtering, struggling economy in 1998, I think the Clinton impeachment would have been much different.
Yeah, but we don't have that
Like many people said, if we had been winning in Vietnam and we hadn't had that bogged down, Watergate would have been significantly different. So, we'll see.
I kind of welcome the Republicans to take their best shot, because I think it's going to blow up in their faces, and I think it would be a great thing for my party and Hillary Clinton. So I hope they take their best shot after the election. So, all right. Before we get to our next story, we'd like to thank two new and very generous supporters this week. First,
woo-hoo.
there's William from Richmond, Virginia, who writes, "I love the show. Thanks for making it." Well, thank you, William.
Thank you, William.
Yeah, we really appreciate your support. And second is Una from London, England, another one of our international listeners who says she just discovered the show and she loves it.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
Yeah, we really do appreciate the help. It means a lot to us, not just financially, which of course it does, but also it's so gratifying to know that you're willing to support us like that. And if you're interested in helping us keep the show going, you can do what William and Una did. Just go to politicsguys.com and click on either our PayPal or Patreon donation links we've got up there. We would, of course, really appreciate it. We've also put together some special rewards for our listeners and supporters, which you can check out by clicking on the listener rewards link on our site.
And did we mention last week that all those rewards are retroactive to
yes.
all our people? Okay.
Yeah, so if you've already contributed and you're saying, where's my stuff? Just send us
I
an email
screwed.
And say, yeah, where's my stuff? And we will get that out to you. The Politics Guy sticker should be coming back from the factory. I don't know where the factory is, but the factory sometime in the next week or so, and we will get those out. And there's other stuff as well. So, and finally, it'd be a big help if you could spread the word about the show by sharing and retweeting our new show posts on Facebook and Twitter and leaving reviews and ratings of the show on iTunes, as so many of you have already done. Thank you very much. Okay. Now, Jay, I cannot tell you how happy I am to get away from Trump and Clinton for a little bit and talk about an actual policy story. It's so nice because, you know, I'm a policy geek at heart. Well,
as am I.
Yep. Well, this week.
I'm more an ideology geek.
I think.
Go ahead.
Yeah. So. Well, this week, Aetna, the health insurer Aetna, announced it would dramatically cut back its participation in Obamacare exchanges, quitting 11 states and remaining in only 4 markets nationwide. Now, a number of other major insurers have also scaled back on Obamacare plan participation to the point where it's now estimated that in 2017, next year, 664 counties will have only one insurer in an Obamacare exchange, and that's up from 225 this year. So that's a pretty big gain. Now, some on the left are claiming that Aetna, which as recently as May said it was strongly committed to Obamacare, that it made its decision as the result of the Justice Department suing to block its merger with Humana. Now, the big question for me is, why are insurers pulling out of Obamacare, and what does this mean for what is unquestionably the biggest legislative victory of President Obama's time in office? What do you think, Jay?
I think it is a situation where I'm going to there's a great line in the Radiohead song Fake Plastic Trees, which is one of the most beautiful songs ever written, and I would expect should be played at my funeral, but that gravity always wins. And I think that's what this is. I mean, you can defy the markets, you can defy gravity, you can defy the natural laws of supply and demand for a certain period of time, given a certain amount of effort. But in the end, those fundamentals are always going to operate. And Aetna is not making money on these things; they're losing plenty of money. They tried to get into a merger, which would have allowed them to maybe shoulder those losses for a longer period of time. And the government said no. So I think what you're seeing is gravity winning. The artificial rules that were put in place to hold this together. And some of this has to do with, for example, let me pull up the name of the program. Well, I'm not going to have the name of the program in front of me. But the idea is that healthier companies with a healthier mix, risk mix, are essentially having to subsidize those with the less healthy mix. And again, it just isn't working. So
yeah, I largely agree with you. I mean, what insurers have said more or less across the board is that they underestimated how sick – the people that would sign up for these exchanges would be. One of the big problems is one of the healthiest groups, of course, is younger people, and they have not been signing up and in the numbers that was hoped. And some think it's because the penalty for not signing up isn't great enough, and they just figure, well, it's just worth my while to pay the penalty instead of signing up for insurance, which costs a lot more. And so, I mean, you're right, I think, in that if they can't make money on this, why would they be involved? And so that's why I think this whole idea about Aetna, you know, pulling out of peak with, you know, out of being miffed at the Obama administration about the merger thing. I think, no, it's a business decision. And I think fundamentally.
And here's something else. Yeah, businesses operate based, I would say most businesses, you can maybe put the Trump thing in a, you know, Trump stuff in a different category. They typically don't operate out of peak. They operate based on whether they're making money or not.
Yeah.
Emotions don't particularly matter.
No, not at all. And, you know, from the beginning, I've had my doubts about Obamacare, but that goes back to, and one of these days we might want to do a whole Ask the Politics Guys about it, our incredibly screwy healthcare insurance system where every single incentive in the system, it seems seemingly designed to push high cost and not so great results. I mean, it's a horrible system. No one but an insane person would design a healthcare system like the one we have today. And weirdly enough, this is something that people on the left and the right can agree on, though the left and the right obviously have very different solutions to this. And so, yeah, it's great. And in one way, you should say Obamacare has been a success in the sense that millions and millions of people who did not have any insurance now have insurance. But in terms of the larger problem of making good health care affordable for everyone, it really hasn't done nearly what its proponents said it would do. And it's no surprise to me.
Yeah. And I would say, again, you know, the biggest piece of Obamacare, to the extent you want to call it a success, and I wouldn't call it that, but it's just simply been they've expanded the Medicaid rolls,
right?
The portion of it of people getting private insurance that would be valuable to them, that wouldn't have such high deductibles, that it's essentially the same as being uninsured. That has not worked. So,
yeah, I mean,
we'll see how this goes. But at some point, there's going to have to be a change, or you're going to hit that level that had been talked about when this was being passed, that you get that is what's called a death spiral, where you're just never able to get the mass to have enough healthy people making up for all the sick people, and the whole thing just kind of collapses.
Yeah, I think definitely it's going to prove to be unsustainable. I never thought Obamacare was going to be a long-term solution for anything. I thought it was a fatally flawed compromise, and I think that's just proving to be correct. It's unfortunate, because it would be great if I would – it would be great if I were wrong.
Your use of the word compromise is interesting, though, but –
Well, I mean, it was a compromise in the sense that it certainly wasn't the plan that the left really wanted. It was the best plan that could be pushed through the political system. But sure. Again, when we're dealing with
I'm just pointing out there was no Republican involvement in it whatsoever.
Well, it was a compromise just to get enough votes.
To get enough Democrats.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's because on a lot of issues, when there's really big money involved, and obviously in healthcare there's big money involved, people, these kind of partisan differences can fade somewhat. And when the lobbying can be so intense, you take a look at the lessons of why the Bill Clinton health care reform failed, in part because they didn't take into account what the lobbyists would want and what the vested interests would want. Well, Obama did that. But in doing that, in crafting something that was able to get through the political process, it was, I think, inevitably something that was going to be not very good. And that's kind of my take on Obamacare.
All right.
So it's time for Under the Radar, where we highlight a story from the last week we feel didn't get the attention it deserved. So my Under the Radar story for this week is about the Fight for 15, the national minimum wage proposal that was pushed by Bernie Sanders and then sort of awkwardly embraced by Hillary Clinton, like she awkwardly embraced a number of Sanders proposals. So here's some background. In 2014, the city of Seattle passed a $15 an hour minimum wage law, which went into effect last year, on April 1st, it turns out, in 2015. A group called the Seattle Minimum Wage Study Team has taken a look at the first year of the program, comparing Seattle to surrounding demographically similar areas in the region, and they recently released a report with their conclusions. Now, their one unsurprising finding was that hourly wages did, in fact, rise modestly, which you would expect. But they also found that hours of employment for low-wage workers declined. And in the end, they concluded it was basically a wash. In other words, the decline in hours essentially offset the increase in pay. Now, they point out that it's still very early and it might take more time for the effects of the law to become fully evident. They also, it's also important to point out this is only one study. But the reason I think this is important and worth mentioning is kind of goes back to my belief that big changes in policy often have unexpected consequences, which is why I'm for smaller scale tests of policy ideas like the $15 an hour minimum wage in Seattle. And it's also why I'm not yet in favor of the national minimum wage fight for 15 thing. Because to me, the best approach is to wait and see what happens at the local level, at a regional level, before we commit the entire country to a new standard. I mean, I'm all for increasing worker wages and doing something about income inequality. I think those are huge and pressing and almost critical problems. But I think we need to be smart about how we go about it and not just enact things for the whole country because they sound like a good idea.
Okay. Well, I think you're half right on that.
Well, I guess I'll take that. Explain. What do you agree with and what do you disagree with?
I would say that the findings to say that this is, I guess, unexpected results. No, I think that's pretty much what everybody expected and what they said would happen. People would get their hours cut. So what this means is you have more people sort of working harder, I suppose, to try to get done what they need to get done. This is, I mean, it's not hard math or policy question to me. Is if you raise the cost of doing business, are you going to get more businesses opening, more businesses hiring? If you increase the cost of labor, it just isn't going to happen. And
well, that's where I think you're wrong.
I think this is going to sort of continue to play out. And the place where it hurts the most, you know, ironically. Is the place where it's needed most. I mean, I think what you need isn't so much more a higher minimum wage, but more jobs, jobs that can maybe start at the minimum wage and then increase. Because I think you would agree with me, the numbers bear out that for people, once you get up past that minimum wage threshold bracket, you're into something else. You know, the minimum wage doesn't really matter that much for you. And it's a difference of letting people break into the employment system, so to speak, or not. And I think that's raising a minimum wage like this leads to fewer jobs, for people who don't have a whole lot of skills to begin with and need a place to get into the system.
Yeah, well, you know, where I think you're wrong on this is that you have your theory, and I know you, that's shared with many of your friends on the right, your friends in whatever, your ilk on the right. But it's just that. It's an economic theory, and what I'm saying is we can put this to the test. And I have my theory, you know, and so you made a number of claims, and I'm saying, okay, maybe those claims are valid and maybe they're not, but before I commit myself to the fight for 15, and I would argue before you just decide out of hand that this is a bad idea, it makes a lot more sense to see what happens at the local level and base our conclusions not on our ideology, but what the evidence tells us.
Well, fair enough. But I would submit that the evidence thus far tends to support the conservative side of the argument that when you just raise wages, you don't create more jobs.
Well, it seems to me that the evidence is very equivocal right now and that there's no real clear effect on economic growth. There's no real clear effect on wages. And so that's why I'm taking a wait and see. I'm remaining open-minded about this and we'll see what happens.
All right.
Did you say you have an under-the-radar story for this week, Jay?
No, actually, mine was going to be same thing, the same.
There you go. So I guess we both caught that. All right, excellent. All right, so moving on to our non-political thoughts of the week. I actually have a non-political thought of the week, though. Once again, it's sort of, I guess you'd say, semi-political, and it's also yet another recommendation. I don't watch a ton of TV. And over the years, I found that I can safely ignore one network in particular, which is CBS. CBS never seems to air anything I find even remotely appealing. But that's changed recently. There's a newish show on CBS. It's in its first season, at least, called Brain Dead. I don't know if you're familiar with it, Jay?
Nope.
Okay, well, it's written by the people who did The Good Wife, which is a show I have kind of mixed feelings about. I enjoyed the first few seasons, then it got a little too ridiculous. But anyway, Brain Dead is set in Washington, D.C. where alien bugs are crawling into the ears of politicians and their staffers, eating half of their brains, and turning them into raving partisans.
Hmm.
As what apparently is part of, and I haven't gone far enough to know yet, to be an alien bug people plot to take over the country. It's smart. It's funny. It's got Tony Shalhoub in a great role. Tony Shalhoub is one of
I do like Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah, he's back from the Wings days even. I liked him. And if you love politics, it's definitely worth checking out. And best of all, it's streaming on Amazon and free if you're an Amazon Prime member. I am totally hooked on it. And I think it's a great show, well worth checking out.
It harkens back shades of Robert A. Heinlein. It's the Puppet Masters, from what it sounds like to me, right?
Boy, you know, I wouldn't have a
clue. You've read that, right?
No, not at all. Not even familiar. Not even – I mean, I know who Heinlein is, but not familiar at all with the Puppet Masters. So.
Well, it's the same sort of deal. Aliens sort of, you know, controlling our brains through little – but anyway.
Cool.
That's a good recommendation.
I think so. So what about you, Jay? Have any non-political thoughts or recommendations?
My non-political thought, although now I want to go on a tear and tell everybody to go out and start reading Robert A. Heinlein. It has to do with watching the Olympics and a little bit with listening to Trump. And that is sort of thinking about greatness, you know, and the Trump, you know, the theme of Make America Great Again.
Sure.
And it's just, I think – With the Olympics, you know, it's really on display that we get to see true greatness. And talking about, you know, Michael Phelps and Usain Bolt and Simone Biles and these folks who do things that are in many ways just superhuman. And that we ought to just take a minute every so often. Not every 4 years, but to recognize this human greatness. And whether you want to ascribe it to human greatness or sort of great God-given talent or sort of the combination of the two, I think that lifts our lives up a little bit. And I would say that this ought to expand not just to athletic greatness, but, you know, take some time and, you know, go to the library and if they have CDs, listen to a Beethoven symphony, listen to a Shostakovich symphony. You can get these, you know, as you pointed out with your book recommendations a couple weeks ago. I mean, so much is available online for free or virtually for free. And it's always been available at your public library. And we have the ability to reach out and touch sort of this, you know, greatness. And I think we ought to take advantage of it more often than we do.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a great non-political thought, a great recommendation for sure.
And that's sort of my if you're going to make America great again, that's the way to start.
I couldn't agree more, Jay. All right. Well, that's it for this week's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you have any thoughts, comments, criticisms, or questions for Ask the Politics Guys, we would love to hear from you. Our email is politicsguys, one word, at gmail.com. Our Facebook page, where we post throughout the week, is facebook.com/politicsguyspage. We're also on Twitter at politicsguys. If you're interested in helping us keep the show going, sharing and retweeting our new show posts and tweets and reviewing the show on iTunes really helps. And if you'd like to support the show financially, you can do that through the PayPal or Patreon links on our website. And while you're there, be sure to check out our listener rewards. The Politics Guys will be back next Sunday. We hope you'll join us.